This is the fifth day of this November 2009 7-day session. And we're going to take up a koan today. This is from the Mumon Kan, usually translated as the Gateless Barrier. It's the most widely known collection of koans, Zen koans. And number 23, think neither good nor evil. I'm going to forego the reading of the case because I'm not sure how far we're going to get today in the preamble, the biographical material about the sixth patriarch. I'll just sum it up so we have some context for the biography. After the sixth patriarch received the robe and the bowl in Dharma transmission from the fifth patriarch, he set off, and one of the more, enthusiastic monks went off in pursuit of it, thinking that it had been taken wrongfully. And when he finally caught up to him, there was this dramatic encounter where the sixth patriarch laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "Go ahead, take them." And Monk Myo froze. And then the patriarch threw this challenge to him, thinking neither good nor evil at this very moment. What is the original face of Monk Myo? And that Myo was enlightened. That's the outline of the case. But now let's go back. I haven't read this in quite a few years, and I'm going to go through reading the autobiography, actually, of the sixth patriarch. He was born in somewhere around the mid-600s, and he is, to this day, very, very highly revered, not only in China, but in all through Zen, as the person who really put his stamp on Zen as we know it today. Bodhidharma is usually considered the founder of Zen, and rightfully so, for his popularizing this wall gazing, facing the wall. But it was the sixth patriarch who made it fully Chinese and gave it its essential quality that has come down to us today. I'm reading from there are several translations of the this is the beginning of the Platform Sutra, or the Sutra of Wei Nung. It has both names. The sutra actually begins with this autobiography. The case can be made it's not a sutra, technically, because sutras are supposed to be the purported words of the Buddha, but it has come down to be referred to as a sutra, the Platform Sutra of the sixth patriarch. And it begins with him before his actual teaching, of him telling his life story. "Now let me tell you something about my own life and how I came into possession of the teaching of the Zen school." There'll be parts in here where I'll just sort of summarize it. Like now, his father was an official and ran into disfavor with the court, and he was banished. He says, "I was unlucky in that my father died when I was very young, leaving my mother poor and miserable. We moved to Guangzhou, That's in the deep in the south of China. It's one of the hotter places in China. We moved to Guangzhou, formerly Canton, and were then in very bad circumstances. I'm sorry, this translation, I always want to give the translator credit. This was translated by A.F. Price and Wang Mulam. I was selling firewood in the market one day when one of my customers ordered some to be brought to his shop. Upon delivery being made and payment received, I left the shop and at that moment heard a man reciting a sutra. As soon as I heard the text of this sutra, my mind at once became enlightened. Thereupon, I asked the man the name of the book he was reciting and was told that it was the Diamond Sutra. According to one source, the actual line that opened his mind was arouse the mind without its abiding anywhere. But it's not clear that was the actual line. I further inquired from where he came and why he recited this particular sutra. He replied that he came from Dongshan Monastery in the Huangmei district of Qichao, that the abbot in charge of this temple was Hongjian, the fifth patriarch, that there were about 1,000 disciples under him, and that when he went there to pay homage to the patriarch, he attended lectures on this sutra. He further told me that the fifth patriarch used to encourage the laity as well as the monks to recite this sutra, because by doing so they might realize their own mind and thereby reach Buddhahood directly. It must be due to my good karma in past lives that I heard about this and that I was given a certain sum of money for the maintenance of my mother by a man who advised me to go to Huangmei to meet the fifth patriarch. After arrangements had been made for her, I left for Huangmei, which took me less than 30 days to reach. This would, of course, all be on foot. Now, I'm going to go back and comment on some things here. First of all, how rare it is that one would come to a spontaneous enlightenment. There are very few stories of this in our whole tradition. And it's significant that he was said to be illiterate. Illiterate and a peasant, basically. Before I go any further, let me this whole story of the sixth patriarch is a really illustrious one in the Zen tradition, but it's hard to know how much is factually true and how much is something other than that. Robert Aitken Roshi's commentary on this koan, he talks about this uncertainty of the veracity of this story, and he puts it so well. I'm just going to read what he says. Is it a true story? From very early times, Buddhist history has been retold to present archetypal themes clearly. On examining the internal evidence, most scholars believe the Huineng could not have been illiterate. In fact, the historical validity of the entire sutra is doubtful. Never mind. Scholars seek historical facts. Zen students seek spiritual themes. And he just says, well, then he says, my own view is that where scholarship helps to clarify the themes, it can be very useful. The rest can distract the student of religion from resolving life and death questions. Such chronicles as this should be read for their value as folk stories. And from that perspective, what a fine story it is. Now back to the sutra. So, one example of one of the significant things that may not be true in this story is his illiteracy as an indication of confirmation of Zen as a teaching beyond words and letters without reliance on the sutras. This was how it was most widely known in ancient times, without reliance on words. And the story suggests that, yeah, even an illiterate person. To remember that at this time in China, it was the highest respect that someone would be educated and be a man of letters. And here was this illiterate peasant having this spontaneous awakening. I think it's significant too that that awakening that came to him spontaneously was not enough for him. It's a measure of the depth of his aspiration that he just set about right away to find out where he could train to deepen his realization. Maybe if at the time they had a lecture circuit, he might have gone around talking about his experience. Probably would have got a few books out of it and quite a bit of money, but that wasn't an option. And what we find as we go on here is that what he really wanted was to go further, deeper into, and deepen and enlarge this initial experience. You see the Confucian respect for filial piety with them mentioning that a man gave him the money to give to his mother so she would be provided for. And then he set off for Huangmei Mountain. I then went to pay homage to the patriarch and was asked where I came from and what I expected to get from him. I replied, I am a commoner from Xinchao of Kwangtung. I have traveled far to pay you respect, and I ask for nothing but Buddhahood. Full enlightenment. And then the patriarch, the fifth patriarch, is reported to have said, you are a native of Kwangtung, a barbarian? How can you expect to be a Buddha? Now, we can be sure that this is simply a test of this young, this new arrival, to see how he would respond to that. Challenge. Apparently, at the time, it may have been thought by in some quarters of Buddhism that if you're of that class, if you're a bumpkin, much less a barbarian, that enlightenment would be something beyond you. We can be sure that the fifth patriarch didn't believe this, and there, but still. He throws down this challenge to him. How can you expect to be a Buddha? And the reply. I replied, although there are northern men and southern men, north and south make no difference to their Buddha nature. A barbarian is different from your holiness physically, but there is no difference in our Buddha nature. And then the account continues. He was going to speak further to me, but the presence of other disciples made him stop short. He then ordered me to join the assembly to work. May I tell your holiness, I said, that prajna, that is transcendental wisdom, enlightened wisdom, prajna often rises in my mind. When one does not go astray from one's own essence of mind, one may be called the field of merits. I do not know what work your holiness would ask me to do. There's a footnote here by this one may be called the Field of Merits. It's a title of honor given to monks, monks in general, as they afford the best opportunities to others to sow the seed of merits. So even as a layman, he said, if you don't go astray from your true nature, you may be called the field of merits. You may be called a monk in the true sense. And then the fifth patriarch replied, "This barbarian is too bright. Go to the stable and speak no more." I then withdrew myself to the backyard and was told by a lay brother to split firewood and to pound rice. And this is another element of the another archetype in this story is sending a newcomer off into the trenches to start in the most simple way, doing the manual labor, and not being close at hand to the master, this master of a thousand monks. And he spent 8 months there pounding rice. Here we see his profound humility. This would be very much respected, the obedience. Here he is, even having had this awakening experience, that he obediently does what he's told, goes off to some corner of this vast monastic complex and spends the next 8 months pounding rice. On one of my pilgrimages in China, we visited the temple there and saw the stone itself that is reputed to have been the one he used to pound rice. It looked pretty authentic, pretty worn and impressive. More than 8 months after, the patriarch saw me one day and said, "I know your knowledge of Buddhism is very sound, but I have to refrain from speaking to you lest evildoers should do you harm. Do you understand?" "Yes, sir, I do," I replied. "To avoid people taking notice of me, I dare not go near your hall." And here again, we're given a glimpse into human nature. In this case, where someone new like that, who had the temerity to address the fifth patriarch as he did right upon his arrival, could be regarded with a great deal of jealousy by the other monks who'd been there longer. doesn't fit our romantic ideas about what monks and should be like and what monasteries should be like, but I think it's realistic. Especially if the other monks were educated, they would be an unusual monk, an unusual educated monk who'd put in some time there, who wouldn't look at this young upstart and want to muscle him out of the way. One day the patriarch assembled all his disciples and said to them, "The question of incessant rebirth is a momentous one. Day after day, instead of trying to free yourselves from this bitter sea of life and death, you seem to go after tainted merits only. Yet merits will be of no help if your essence of mind is obscured." To pause here and mention that this was a very common understanding of spiritual practice and Buddhist practice at the time, was that if you could just be a good enough monk and do what you're told and work hard, that you're going to build up enough merit, like enough good karma, in other words, that then you could expect a favorable rebirth and possibly even awakening. Yet merits will be of no help if your essence of mind is obscured. Go and seek for prajna in your own mind, and then write me a stanza about it. He who understands what the essence of mind is will be given the robe and the Dharma, and I shall make him the sixth patriarch. Go away quickly. Don't delay in writing the stanza, because deliberation is quite unnecessary and of no use. The one who has realized the essence of mind can speak of it at once, as soon as he is spoken to about it, and he cannot lose sight of it, even when engaged in battle. All right, so the reader here is reminded that this understanding, this realization is not something that requires thinking. If it is realized, meaning made real, if it's made real, it's in the body. If it's in the body, then one just responds. One doesn't have to sit and think of one's answer. So the disciples heard this, and they withdrew and said to one another, "It's of no use for us to concentrate our mind to write the stanza and submit it to the master, since the patriarchate is bound to be won by Shen Shu, our instructor." He's the head monk. "And if we write perfunctorily, if we just go through the motions and write something, it will only be a waste of energy." Upon hearing this, all of them made up their minds not to write and said, "Why should we take the trouble? Hereafter, we will simply follow our instructor, Shen Shu, wherever he goes, and look to him for guidance." Well, this isn't hard to believe, that these rank and file monks, most of whom probably, according to all that I've read, most of whom were not there for the best reasons. They were not monks in their true in their heart, but just wanted to have a good, steady 3 square meals a day and get by and, you know, load up on some merit before they died. That they could say this, especially in the hierarchical structure of a monastery that was to be expected in a Confucian country. We see here that they that this Shen Shu, the head monk, was popular, or at least they looked up to him, and were happy to just defer to him and let him do the heavy lifting. But it wasn't to be for Shen Shu. He reasoned thus with himself, "Considering that I am their teacher, none of them will take part in the competition. I wonder whether I should write a stanza and submit it to the master. If I do not, how can he know how deep or superficial my knowledge is? If my object is to get the Dharma, my motive is a pure one. If I were after the patriarchate, then it would be bad. In that case, my mind would be that of a worldling, and my action would amount to robbing the patriarch's holy seat. But if I do not submit the stanza, I shall never have a chance of getting the Dharma. A very difficult point to decide indeed." So the author of this text, of this sutra, is giving us a little peek into the thought processes of this head monk, who would have served as very much as a teacher to many of these monks. Certainly, the fifth patriarch couldn't manage to teach 1,000 monks in a hands-on way, and would have had to delegate the head monk and probably others too as junior teachers. So he feels the duty, the responsibility to come up with something, but he questions his motives. It's very commendable. He's saying, if my goal is to just get the robe and the bowl, well, that's not much of a motive. I would just be like any worldly person who's just striving for success and honor. It would show a lack of integrity as a monk. But if I don't just come up with something, then I won't have a chance of getting the Dharma. That's the phrase that's used here. So he's confusing getting the Dharma, getting the authentic understanding, confusing that with just getting the robe and the bowl, which is a mistake that, as we'll see, this other monk Myo made as well. So he's tormented. We go on. "In front of the patriarch's hall, there were three corridors, the walls of which were to be painted by a court artist with pictures from the Lankavatara Sutra, depicting the transfiguration of the assembly of monks, and with scenes showing the genealogy of the five patriarchs. When Shen Shu had composed his stanza, he made several attempts to submit it to the patriarch, but as soon as he went near the hall, his mind was so perturbed that he sweated all over. He could not screw up the courage to submit it, although in the course of 4 days, he made altogether 13 attempts to do so." This poor guy, dragging himself there out of a sense of duty. That sense of duty would have enabled him to rise in the ranks of monks and become the head monk. But it doesn't help him now when everything is at stake. Even 13 is a favorite number in Buddhism, has symbolic significance. Then he suggested to himself, "It would be better for me to write it on the wall of the corridor and let the patriarch see it for himself. If he approves it, I shall come out to pay homage and tell him that it was done by me. But if he disapproves it, then I shall have wasted several years in this mountain in receiving homage from others that I by no means deserve. In that case, what progress have I made in Buddhism? At 12 o'clock that night, he went secretly with a lamp to write the stanza on the wall of the south corridor so that the patriarch might know what spiritual insight he had attained. The stanza read, this is one of the most famous verses in all of Zen. He wrote, "Our body is the Bodhi tree, and our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour, and let no dust alight." So he had heard this true mind of ours compared to a mirror that has no forms or images itself, but reflects all forms. So he got that. And he had also heard, this surely was not, didn't originate with him, he had heard that in doing Zazen, it is as though we're polishing this mirror. The dust of thought accumulate hour by hour. We do Zazen, we wipe it clean. They accumulate again, we do more Zazen, we wipe it clean. They keep accumulating. As long as we keep doing Zazen, we'll keep that mirror bright. As far as the work, the daily work that we need to do, it's fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't get to the essence of this Dharma. As soon as he had written it, he left it once for his room, so nobody knew what he had done. In his room, he again pondered, "When the patriarch sees my stanza tomorrow and is pleased with it, I shall be ready for the Dharma. But if he says that it is badly done, it will mean that I am unfit for the Dharma, owing to the misdeeds in previous lives that thickly becloud my mind. It is difficult to know what the patriarch will say about it." In this vein, he kept on thinking until dawn, as he could neither sleep nor sit at ease. Well, we know everything we need to know about this head monk to be sure that he was not ready to receive Dharma transmission. And you can be sure that the fifth patriarch knew this. He would have known the mind of his head monk as well as of anyone in the monastery, and it would be as plain as day to him that this was not his man. And yet there was this newcomer who had left quite an impression on the fifth patriarch, and who he knew had had an awakening. And says, "But the patriarch knew already that Shen Shu had not entered the door of enlightenment and that he had not known the essence of mind. In the morning, he sent for the artist who was going to paint the scenes on the wall and went with him to the south corridor to have the walls painted with pictures. And by chance, he saw the stanza. And he said to the artist, 'I am sorry to have troubled you to come so far. The walls need not be painted now.'" And then he comes up with his reason. "As the sutra says, all forms or phenomena are transient and elusive. It will be better to leave the stanza here so that people may study it and recite it. If they put its teaching into actual practice, they will be saved from the misery of being born in the evil realms of existence. the merit gained by one who practices it will be great indeed. So here, what we gain from this is the teaching. This is all sprinkled with basic Buddhist teaching, is that yes, that just sitting every day faithfully, earnestly, by doing that, we do gain merit. We will tend to not fall into the worst states of existence. If we're good monks, good practitioners, uphold the precepts, then there's not that much bad we're doing, and at least we're not losing ground in this lifetime. He then ordered incense to be burned and all his disciples to pay homage to it and to recite it so that they might realize the essence of mind. After they had recited it, all of them exclaimed, "Well done." It's interesting that he, at this point, he was still showing real respect for that stanza. At midnight, of course it had to be midnight, the patriarch sent for Shen Shu to come to the hall and asked him whether the stanza was written by him or not. "It was, sir," replied Shen Shu. "I dare not be so vain as to expect to get the patriarchate, but I wish your holiness would kindly tell me whether my stanza shows the least grain of wisdom." Fishing for some compliment there and some affirmation. But this isn't the 21st century, and the head monk doesn't get a medal for competing. And the patriarch says, "Your stanza shows that you have not yet realized the essence of mind. So far, you have reached the door of enlightenment, but you have not yet entered it. To seek for supreme enlightenment with such an understanding as yours can hardly be successful." To attain supreme enlightenment, one must be able to know spontaneously one's own nature or essence of mind, which is neither created nor can it be annihilated. From kshana to kshana, which we have here, the translator puts in brackets, thought moment to thought moment, one should be able to realize the essence of mind all the time. All things will then be free from restraint, that is, emancipated. Once the essence is known, one will be free from delusion forever, and in all circumstances one's mind is absolute truth. If you can see things in such a frame of mind, you will have known the essence of mind, which is supreme enlightenment. This kshana, or thought moment, is in Japanese is nen. That's what we're referring to in the Kanongyo when we say this moment arises from mind, this moment itself is mind. And then the fifth patriarch further says to him, "You'd better go back to think it over again for a couple of days and then submit me another stanza." He knows that thinking isn't going to help this guy. "If your stanza shows that you have entered the door of enlightenment, I will transmit to you the robe and the Dharma." So he was saying this, even though he knew that thinking for a couple more days was hardly the way to enter the door of enlightenment. Surely he gave him these instructions so that the head monk himself would see that he wasn't ready. Shen Shu prostrated to the patriarch and left. For several days he tried in vain to write another stanza. This upset his mind so much that he was as ill at ease as if he were in a nightmare, and he could find comfort neither in sitting nor in walking. Well, that tells us where we get by dwelling in our thoughts. 2 days after, it happened that a young boy who was passing by the room where I was pounding rice recited loudly the stanza written by Shen Shu. As soon as I heard it, I knew at once that the composer of it had not yet realized the essence of mind. For although I had not been taught about it at that time, I already had a general idea of it. Well, he had the experience. "What stanza is this?" I asked the boy. "You barbarian," he replied. "Don't you know about it? The patriarch told his disciples that the question of incessant rebirth was a momentous one, that those who wished to inherit his robe and dharma should write him a stanza, and that the one who had an understanding of the essence of mind would get them and be made the sixth patriarch. The elder Shen Shu wrote this formless stanza on the wall of the south corridor, and the patriarch told us to recite it. He also said that those who put its teaching into actual practice would attain great merit and be saved from the misery of being born in the evil realms of existence." I told the boy that I wished to recite the stanza too, so that I might have an affinity with its teaching in future life. I also told him that although I had been pounding rice there for 8 months, I had never been to the hall, and that he would have to show me where the stanza was to enable me to make obeisance to it. So here he's very skillfully withholding from this kid his own understanding in order to play this out. The boy took me there, and I asked him to read it to me, as I am illiterate. A petty officer of the Changzhou district named Chang Qiyong, who happened to be there, read it out to me. When he had finished reading, I told him that I also had composed a stanza and asked him to write it for me. "Extraordinary indeed," he exclaimed, "that you also can compose a stanza?" "Don't despise a beginner," I said. "If you are a seeker of supreme enlightenment, you should know that the lowest class may have the sharpest wit, while the highest may be in want of intelligence." Oh, the highest like you, buddy. "If you slight others, you commit a very great transgression." "Dictate your stanza," he said. "I will take it down for you. But do not," this is great, "but do not forget to deliver me should you succeed in getting the Dharma." My stanza read, okay, here we go. "There is no Bodhi tree, nor stand of a mirror bright. Since all is void, where can the dust alight?" This goes to the essence of the Buddha's teaching and experience. This is the formless Dharma. That despite all appearances, despite all the appearances of all the phenomena, both physical and immaterial phenomena in this world, it's all nothing, no thing. When he had written this, all the disciples and others who were present were greatly surprised. Filled with admiration, they said to one another, "How wonderful! No doubt we should not judge people by appearance. How can it be that for so long we have made a bodhisattva incarnate work for us?" Seeing that the crowd was overwhelmed with amazement, the patriarch rubbed off the stanza with his shoe, lest jealous ones should do me injury. He expressed the opinion, which they took for granted, that the author of this stanza had also not yet realized the essence of mind. He was just buying time, of course. And the monks, just like morons. They just, okay, all right, whatever you say. Yeah, we knew that. He didn't know. Next day, the patriarch came secretly to the room where the rice was pounded. Seeing that I was working there with a stone pestle, he said to me, "A seeker of the path risks his life for the Dharma. Should he not do so?" Then he asked, "Is the rice ready?" "Ready long ago," I replied, "only waiting for the sieve, waiting to be sifted, waiting to be refined." This is someone who understands the way practice and enlightenment work, that there's no beginning to enlightenment or end to practice, no beginning to practice or end to enlightenment, as Dogen said, "Ready long ago," I replied, "only waiting for the sieve." You could say it was ready a long, long, long time ago, since in our original nature, there is only this Buddha mind. And then the fifth patriarch knocked the mortar thrice with his stick and left. Knowing what his message meant, in the third watch of the night, I went to his room. Well, as anyone would know, with three strikes of a stick, that meant to come to the patriarch's quarters. The third watch of the night, I can't remember, middle of the night somewhere. Each watch, so-called watch, is 2 hours long. The third watch of the night would be in the middle of the night. I went to his room. Using the robe as a screen so that none could see us, he expounded the Diamond Sutra to me. When he came to the sentence, "One should use one's mind in such a way that it will be free from any attachment," I at once became thoroughly enlightened and realized that all things in the universe are the essence of mind itself. And we're going to have to stop here and resume tomorrow, and we'll recite now the four vows.